This is Edward October, host of October Pod on YouTube. Hear that jingle jingle? It could be Kris Kringle, or a home invader looking for an open window, a jilted lover looking for revenge, or a disgruntled co-worker hoping to spike your eggnog with arsenic. The girls of our true crime podcast are always on Santa's nice list, but the crimes they discuss are very naughty indeed. Listener discretion is advised.
Hey, Jen, hey!
Hey, what's going on?
Oh, you know, it is tis the season, and we know what that means. Today is day three of all that chipper charm and murder we bring you on the 12 days, or 12 nightmares before Christmas, I believe is the correct title.
12 nightmares of Christmas. Yes, it's my favorite time of the year.
Yeah, it's yeah.
When and murder it's really reigns dear.
Only November 18th. That's the best part, because look at us go. We might not be able to record correctly, and we might have to do it five times, but this is a first. We are starting a full month ahead of time. That doesn't mean much. I'm sure something will happen. It'll crash.
It will.
I don't know. Whatever.
Shush. Shut your H-O-R mouth.
Hockey. Double hockey sticks.
Stick.
Something. Yeah. All right, Jen. As we've established last year with what would now become our annual tradition of the 12 nightmares before Christmas.
Woo-hoo.
We feature a case, a story, in which the number of victims corresponds with the day of Christmas, the prior days of Christmas, as we've established. But the other thing that I want to point out is that these, because we're jamming these all in and cutting and doing everything else, they're not deeply researched.
We just kind of slapped them together.
A little bit.
How's that?
A little bit. Yeah, like that.
Yeah.
Not
sloppy. Did read about it, but we didn't deep dive. Yeah, we didn't deep dive like we normally do.
Yeah. 12 days, right? 12 episodes in 12 days.
Right.
That's pretty good. Just saying.
Yeah. And we get tired.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. You ready?
All right. Yep. Let's go. Day three. Day three.
Day three. Today's case takes us north of the border to Chatham, Ontario, Canada. It's Canada for those of you that don't know.
Oh, Canada.
Blame Canada. Blame Canada. That's,
you know. Yep.
Anyway, so the date is October 18th, 1991. There is a local constable. He's pulled over taking, you know, a break, making some notes, paperwork that he had been putting off till the later part of the day, as we all can relate to that. When all of a sudden, a woman who's panicked, she's frantic, she comes running up to him. She's barely able to get her words out. She's saying, they're dead, they're dead, they're all dead. She's begging the officer to come with her, right? So he's kind of like, what's going on? So they go to her house, and the house is a scene right out of a movie, okay? It's pretty graphic, it's pretty disturbing. Barely clinging to life and laying on the floor is a woman who has been stabbed repeatedly. Now, this woman later would be identified as 73-year-old Virginia Critchley. Now, before she passed, she was able to give investigators a little bit of information. It wasn't much, and barely able to speak, she whispered, two boys. The phrase, two boys, meaning, you know, you could guess that she's saying two boys did this. Police converge. They all arrive on the scene at the same time. They're not sure what they're walking into, but one thing's for sure, this was not a common occurrence in Chatham. Another victim, named Alfred Critchley, age 75, was located inside the bathroom of the home. Now, just like magic, I swear, there's always just something that makes, I don't know, just makes everything come together. And I always say that, right? Like, I think that. So Alfred was in the bathroom, and as he was struck and falling, he actually grabbed onto an outlet, like a cord, right? The cord was attached to a clock, right? So the clock froze at the moment he hit the ground. So that's pretty nice, right, for investigators. The time was 5:12 p.m., so that meant he was attacked at 5:12 that very day. Alfred, still breathing at this time, was rushed to the hospital. Sadly, Virginia would never leave the house. She died right after uttering the phrase, two boys.
She was 72, you said,
She was 73, and that was her husband, Alfred, who was 75.
And you know, I've been to Chatham.
You have? Shut up. Where is
Ontario.
It?
Ontario.
Well, it's in Ontario.
It's probably about, it's close to Detroit, actually.
Oh.
My family is in Bothwell, Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where my grandmother was from. Mm-hmm. And I want to say it's maybe 4 hours from Detroit. I'm not for sure. But Bothwell is about 33 minutes away from Chatham.
So. Is it cold up there?
Not when I went. Okay. It was summertime. It was nice. We went to Chatham to shop.
When the living's easy.
I'm sorry. Chatham is an hour from Detroit.
That's okay. I wouldn't have known either way. I've been to Canada, but not there.
Well, other folk might have.
I'm just saying.
Other people that listened.
I got you. The woman who flagged down the constable to come to the house would turn out to be Connie Pangburn, and she was the mother of 19-year-old Jason Pangburn. Now, Jason was living in the house with Connie and Richard, his parents. Virginia, now you got to stay with me because this confused me a little bit. Virginia was Richard's mother, and Alfred was Richard's stepfather, okay? So Virginia, the older lady that died, would be Jason's dad's mom, and then the stepdad, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Investigators are really freaked out now. They are scared that Jason, who lives there and was supposed to have been at home, is somewhere in the house. And they're, you know, Connie's freaking out. They're afraid to continue through the house, but they know they have to. And they honestly think they're going to find him deceased in the house as well. Okay. So as police work, as police are working to secure the scene, they make their way up to Jason's bedroom. They go in and he's not in there. But what they do notice immediately is Jason's empty gun rack. Okay. So he had a gun rack in his room and it featured some really nice guns. He liked guns, and we'll get into that in a minute. Okay. As police question Connie, they ask Connie about the guns. Connie informs them that Jason was a big hunter, and he had them as he was preparing to go to the reserves. And that is why he was supposed to be home at that moment. So he was supposed to be at that house at that time, right? Because he was getting ready to go to the reserves. She is in shock when the officers inform her that he's not up there, which is good, but all the guns are missing, and Jason's not there either. Okay, so at first, I'm sure they're all thinking the worst, obviously, you know, because we've been doing true crime long enough, we know what happens. Police ask Connie where Jason's dad, which is Connie's husband, is, and she tells them that he's out of town on business, but she'd called him and he was heading back immediately. Officers continue to press Connie as to where Jason could be, where Jason is. I mean, could he have gone anywhere? Is he outside shooting his guns? Did he go with somebody, a stranger? They don't know. They're just trying to figure out things because nobody knows where Jason is at this point, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Investigators head to an area nearby with dogs, and they're hoping to get a clue or two. They're hoping, you know, the dogs will maybe hit on a scent that he escaped and they're going to find him. Maybe, I don't know. Well, I do know because I know the story, but you know what I'm saying. It's for effect. Jen. Police on scene. Yeah, you know, police on scene break up. They start to interview some of the neighbors and the people around there. And it's not too long. As we all know, they get some information. A person tells police that he saw a truck, and the truck was like a grayish blue in color, and it was actually parked outside the home not too long ago. As the man was speaking to an officer, a call came in. One of the dog handlers had came upon what they had most dreaded and feared. Jason Pangburn's body was buried in a shallow grave, covered up in brush and leaves and dirt. A large rock had been placed on his face, but you could clearly see that this was the young man that they were looking for. Isn't that awful? Like, they put a rock on his face.
So awful.
Shortly after the discovery of Jason, Alfred Critchley would also pass away on the surgery table. So at this point, Jason and both of his grandparents have passed away, brutally murdered. Investigators know that they have to find who violently attacked these people and why. What was the point? You know, there's no reason for this to happen. And why was Jason away from the house? Why were they in the house? Etc., etc. The bodies are sent to the coroner to examine. And it's determined that Alfred was stabbed 3 times, whereas Virginia was stabbed a total of 23 times.
Oh my gosh.
I found that rather interesting.
Who's mad?
Virginia
had, somebody's mad.
Right? Virginia had succumbed to rapid blood loss. That was the cause of her death. She had several defensive wounds, as well as proving she put up a really good fight at 73 years old, especially. Another shock would make investigators question just what exactly happened that day. Jason was not stabbed at all, but rather shot through the heart. The gun that killed Jason.
Shot through the heart?
Yes, where his grandparents
and
were.
And you're to blame?
Because you give.
Do you give love a bad name?
Sure do, buddy.
You give love a bad name.
So there's a few.
Meow, meow.
So there's a few questions
okay, go ahead, start that
come. That over. There's a few questions that come into play here, and one of them is not, do you give love a bad name? Okay. It is, who was killed first? Was Jason killed first and then the grandparents? Or were the grandparents killed first and then Jason? Also, why two different weapons? Why were they stabbed whereas he was shot?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Why were they?
I'm about to tell you, but I'm gonna take a little drink right now because my throat's a little dry and my lips are really dry.
My lips hurt. Gosh.
It's so hot in this closet. I don't mean because I'm getting lucky. It's hot. Okay. As police continue to talk to the area neighbors and residents, a man says he saw Jason that day at around 4:15 with three boys. And they were all hanging out. They looked like they were having a good time. It seemed like Jason was friends. And it didn't seem like there was anything wrong. You know, as if Jason knew the boys, okay? He told police mm-hmm. that Jason and the boys were just chatting it up and that they had crossed the street and went into the field that he pointed out for the officers. Now, what stood out to the neighbor, and this is can only be spotted by a true diehard fan, because I was like, I don't get it, but stay with me, Jen, because you won't get it either.
Okay.
What stood out?
I'm fairly smart.
What stood out to the neighbor was that one of the boys was wearing a Pittsburgh Penguins jersey, and that was odd.
Okay.
Do you know why?
Because they weren't in Pittsburgh.
Well, yeah, but why would that be odd? What would they be wearing, Jen? Yeah, see, that's my point. You don't know. I didn't know either. And I was like, well, I mean, a good eye, right? But like I said, you're probably only going to know that if you're a huge sports fan. So why that was odd was all the people from that area were fans of either mm-hmm. the Toronto Maple Leafs or the mm-hmm. Detroit Red Wings. The Detroit Red Wings, okay?
Red Wings. Mm-hmm.
Red Wings, okay? So mm-hmm. obviously that stuck out to somebody. But see, like around here, I think St. Louis, you're going to sport Cardinals gear, but you're also, if you're a diehard fan, you're going to sport other stuff. But I guess maybe it'd be like if you were sporting like a Chicago Blackhawks jersey. I mean, that might be a little telling. I don't know. Just think about it.
Well, there's tons of people that wear their Cubs gear or Cowboys. Not that we have a football team anymore, but. And honestly, I don't even pay attention to that kind of stuff. I know that we have the Cardinals and the Blues and whatever mm-hmm. other, I think that's it, right? There's no other sports team here. We're getting a football team, or not a football team.
Soccer. Football.
Soccer.
Football. F-U-T. Ball. Football.
Footy. Mm-hmm. Getting some footies. Yeah.
All right. Back to the story, Jen.
Yeah. All right. All right. Sorry.
So with this information, this is placing Jason with those boys in that field that guy saw him going to at around 4:15 in the afternoon. Now, they know Alfred was killed at exactly 5:12 because he grabbed that cord on the way down to the ground. So they now think, or they're guessing, estimating, that Jason must have been first to be killed. So that leads investigators to a few things, right? So that leads them to have some ideas of maybe a better way to go, a better way to follow an angle. Does that make sense? You know what I'm saying? Versus the mm-hmm. two older ones and So authorities meet. I hate so. I wish she'd get lost. Anyway. Anywho. I'm going to start doing that at the beginning of every sentence. Authorities meet with the public to squash some fears because they're really freaked out about that maybe there's a killer on the loose. And authorities at this time, they're pretty convinced that there's a reason that it wasn't just random that this close-knit family was targeted. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Investigators bring in Connie and Richard, and they want to ask them some questions. Connie brings up something kind of interesting.
She mentions penguins. She has a thing for penguins that are from Pittsburgh.
Wrong.
Or Philadelphia.
Just somewhere up there. Somewhere in the South, mm-hmm. you know. Connie mentions that a few weeks prior, a young man dressed in military fatigues came by the house, and he asked to speak with Private Pangburn. Now, remember, Jason was
Private?
Getting ready.
private.
That's
it's
what I said.
Private.
It is. So he wanted to talk to Jason.
It's private. Jason,
I know, Jennifer, you've made that perfectly clear on every episode. So I'm going to say PRV period or PRT or whatever the short thing is for that word. Okay. You ready?
Just easier if you just say it correctly.
Officer, whatever his name is, Pangburn, Jason. We're going to go by Jason. This person asked to talk to Jason, and the way he asked for Jason reminded her very much of a soldier because it stuck out in her mind that day, the way he was very precise and the way he used the term, calling him more by what he would be known in the reserves rather than a civilian on the street. The color of this person's truck was, guess what, gray-blue.
Ah, killers like those blue cars.
That's the one that the person saw at the house earlier, remember? Police head over to the armory. Now, they want to see what they can find out and talk to some young men over there and, you know, see if they know Jason, if Jason was well-liked, etc. The reservists are very helpful in trying to assist them, but with so many enlisted, so many young men, too, it's really hard to get that far. Many of the men enlisted were there because, I mean, it's kind of like it is here, I guess. They wanted to be there, but there's others that enlist, of course, because they're escaping something, most likely trouble or, you know... You see what I'm saying? Like a lot of times in the States, sometimes that if a person's headed down kind of the wrong path, the other side of the track, if you will, sometimes they'll go into the military to kind of straighten up. Okay.
Yes. That is the truth.
One belief that was shared by all, and that was that Jason was very well liked by all his peers and his supervisor. He was a good kid, a great soldier, and he was an excellent marksman. Often bringing his guns into practice to kind of show off with the other soldiers, as well as to let them have a chance to use these guns. And you'll find out about these particular guns in a minute, because one of them's kind of special. The detective's parting words were, to all the boys they talked to, and men, if you know or see anyone with a Penguins jersey, give us a call. Pretty cool that they zoomed in on that, you know?
Right. Kind of strange.
It didn't take long. The following morning, a call came in, and the person said that there was, in fact, a reservist, and his name was Stephen Hill, and he had a Penguins jersey. And as a matter of fact, Stephen was wearing it that very day, October 18th, the day of the killings. Dun, dun, dun.
Huh.
He's only 18. Why do these people throw their life away so young, you know?
Stupid reasons, I know. Because they're young, and they don't understand that it's... I don't know.
Do they, though? I mean, at 18, you know, killing somebody, that's not okay.
It's not. It's not okay to kill somebody when you're 85.
Well, that's true. But, I mean, they do that, too, so. Police travel back to the armory, and they decide, you know what? We need to look up this Private Hill, and we got a couple questions for him. Now, Stephen Hill admits that he does know Jason, but that they weren't really friends or anything. And, yeah, he did go to high school with him and all, but... Yeah, Jason was 2 years older than him, than Stephen, that is. And yeah, he did have a Penguins jersey, but, you know, he misplaced it. I mean, it must have been a couple weeks ago.
Right.
Again, why are people so stupid, okay? Like, somebody just saw you wearing that, you know what I mean? Like, come on. Note to people out there, if you murder somebody, and don't do it, first of all, but if you do, don't say you lost your clothes a long time ago with the exact same thing. You know what I mean? Come on now. Police are smarter than that. Police tell him that they have it on good authority that he was wearing that very jersey, and just recently. In fact, the day that Jason and his grandparents were brutally murdered. Stephen Hill denies it, still, and he tells police that they're wrong. They were wrong, because they're just wrong. They don't know what they're talking about. Now, at this point, police know that Stephen Hill obviously knows much more than he's saying. However, with nothing else to go on, nothing to hold him, nothing concrete, they have to let Stephen Hill go. But hey, Mr. Hill will be in touch.
Was he in touch?
Just like you with the psychic. Touched.
I'm just kind of touched in the head anyway.
Moments later, a call came in to police, and it was regarding another robbery at a nearby house that was close to the Pangburn household. Again, at this house, there were... more than a few guns stolen. The home belonged to Doug and Catherine Kofell, and they had lived at the residence for a long time with their children, including Jason Kofell, their oldest son. Yes, we have two Jasons in the story. Police go over to the house and knock on the door, and they're greeted by Jason, who answers the door. He tells police that, yeah, you know, the house was broken into. House had been locked, but somebody broke in and they stole a few guns. Right?
Huh.
So Jason apparently, you know, is reporting this robbery. Police look around the house. They notice that the locks weren't broke. Nothing seemed out of place or disturbed. They continue to talk to Jason and find out a little bit more about Jason. They find out that Jason is a reservist, but he did not know Jason Pangburn or Jason Pangburn's grandparents. This Jason, Kofel, tells police that he discovered the missing guns when he returned home from school just a little bit ago, just, you know, like an hour ago. Police ask him which way he drove home, and he tells them, this is why police are so smart sometimes, I swear to goodness. Police ask him which way he drove home, and he tells them he took Main Street, as he always does. Now, sensing that something wasn't quite right about this story, they ask if he was sure about that. You know, you didn't drive, say, past the marina on the way home? And Jason says, mm-hmm. Nope, I didn't. Police then tell him, well, you know, Jason, that truck out front, is that yours? Jason says, yes. Well, that's funny, because the day Jason Pangburn was killed, a witness said a truck just like yours was seen up by the marina. Suddenly, Jason Kofel changes his story and said, oh, yeah, you're right. You know, maybe I did take that way home on that day.
Yeah, right? Just maybe.
Yeah. Funny how people can remember these little details when the police are there to kind of jog your memory. I listened to something,
them,
too,
yeah.
By the way, which I thought was kind of interesting today, because that's what I do. But it was, I mean, we know this, but sometimes when somebody says it and they put it in perspective and you're like, huh, you're right. And it's that when you interrogate somebody, the idea is you just keep at them. You keep asking the same questions in different ways over and over, which we know. We all know mm-hmm. that. And mm-hmm. the thing is because after a while, and you do, you wear them down. That's the whole point. But no matter how tired you are, if it's the truth, that's the only story you know. So it's always going to stay the same.
Right.
But if you're lying, sooner or later, those lies are going to kind of get messed up and they're going to stomp on each other. You know what I mean? And I was like, so really, it's the interrogation's not necessarily to get the story, but to catch you in lies. You know what I mean? For more ammunition.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I just thought that was interesting.
The more you know. But you can also, even if you're not lying, get confused when you're tired.
And that's very true. But you're going to, I think it's little things like this. Do you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
Did you,
mm-hmm.
you didn't go home? You sure? Yeah. You know. All right. Back to the story. At this point, officers, you know, they're pretty calm. They're remaining cool. They do not want to let on that this little Jason Kofel fella just went from a possible person of interest all the way up to the top of the suspect list, right? You just, mm-hmm. you know, they know. So they decide to just let it go for now, and they tell Jason, hey, anything, you remember anything, you need to talk to us, anything comes up, you forgot to tell us, give us a call. Okay, see ya, bye-bye, right? Now, little Jason's going to sit on this for a while, right? Wouldn't you know, Jen, here comes a call, and it comes into the police station soon after. What? A locksmith who said he had just been to a house to change the locks. So mm-hmm. the locksmith tells authorities that the call came from the residence of Mark Hooper, who had phoned the locksmith. Now, here we go. This is where you go, you know, you could be the smartest person in the world and you're still stupid. Mark had called the locksmith at around 3 a.m. in the morning on October 19th. Now, not suspicious at all, being that it's not even 24 hours after the murders, and oh yeah, it's 3 in the morning, but the locksmith said that Mark was at the residence with two other young men. As the locksmith opened the door for the boys, he immediately noticed a bunch of guns in the house, and I'm not talking a small amount, I'm talking an arsenal of guns. And if that wasn't alarming enough, the locksmith added that the boys Mark picked up were carrying something wrapped in a blanket inside the house. Now, it's heavy enough that it took more than one kid to, and we're going to come around to this, took more than one kid to carry it, okay? If you're maybe stealing guns and you call a stranger to let you in your house at 3 a.m. in the morning, don't you think that maybe you'd be like, thanks, Bob. Thanks for letting us in the house. You have a good morning. And then you see him away. Then you go take the stuff wrapped in blankets that takes two people mm-hmm. to carry inside the house. You're probably not going to want to do that in front of, you know, I don't know, a witness, right?
You would think.
But there's one other little small thing, Jen.
Yeah.
You want to guess what one of the boys, what kind of clothing he was wearing, like what he was sporting, if you will.
Did it have little bitty penguins on it?
It had, yeah. I'm not going to say what it was, but it rhymes with Dingwen, okay?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So police race out to speak to Mark Hooper. Mark tells police that he went out to pick up his friends and was simply locked out of his house. No, that could be true. That happened. He called the locksmith when he got back to the house. The locksmith came and unlocked the door for them. Police tell Mark that the locksmith had noted that the boys, were carrying something very heavy inside the house. In fact, it took more than one of them to carry it, and it was wrapped in a blanket. And police wanted to know what that was. Mark, not able to look at the officer in the eyes, looks down and kind of under his breath says, "Guns."
Guns.
The friends that were with Mark that 3 a.m. morning were Jason Cosfell and Stephen Hill. The three of them, along with Jason Pangburn, were all reservists in the Army.
Mm-hmm. They were all in the reserves?
Yes. So that's how they knew each other, okay?
Gotcha.
Now, the truth is about to come out now, Jana. It's crystal clear. You ready? Mark Hooper tells police that Jason Cosfell had been collecting guns, and some of these were stolen, and Cosfell felt, well, honestly, he was kind of afraid that Jason would tell on him, okay? So they had, I guess, what you would call sort of a racket going on. They all knew each other, and they were, you know, starting to do this. And we all know it's illegal. And I know the gun laws here aren't the best, but in Canada, I'm going to guess they're probably even more strict. Am I right?
Right.
So investigators...
I don't think you're allowed to have them unless you have license and only hunting rifles
like
and such.
So say 25 of them would definitely be a no, right? One person having 25 would be a no.
I would think so. I'm not up on the laws of Canada, but I do believe that they're restricted. Yeah.
Yeah. So investigators, they're kind of freaked out right now. They know they need to move fast, and they need to get not only the guns back, but they need to get these boys. They need to get them off the street in case if they were, in fact, the ones that brutally murdered Jason and his grandparents, okay? So they decide to set up a sting, and they want to nab them, take the boys in without incident, and, you know, get them in there, interrogate them. So they bring in Jason Cofell, and he admits that, you know, hey, he may have some guns, and he may have stolen a few, but, you know, he paid for some, too. And more importantly, he had absolutely nothing to do with the murders of Virginia and Alfred and Jason, okay? He tells police that he buried the guns in a field in nearby Dover Township. Authorities know if they can find and connect Pangburn's guns to Cofell, it will be enough to move forward, meaning they will have enough evidence to prove that he was connected to Jason via the guns, thereby connected to possible murders, right?
Okay, right.
Because he already said that he was afraid that Jason was going to go tell on him, okay? Jason was a pretty stand-up kid. He was a pretty good kid, right? The officer above him said he was a really good soldier. He was a good kid. So with this information that Cofell hid these guns in this field, police head over to where he says he placed the guns. Now they look around. There's nothing. There is no guns there. They're searching. There's nothing, okay? So they end up leaving empty-handed. They're starting to think now, did this guy just send us, you know, did he just do this to buy some time? They are none too happy is the bottom line.
Yeah, I would think not.
Police head back over to the Cofell residence, and they're trying to look for anything that may help them in the investigation. In shock, as I guess most parents would be because everybody thinks their little angel's perfect, and unable to believe that their son would ever be capable of one murder, much less three, of course, agree, search my house. You go right ahead, search the ground, everything, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it doesn't take long. Located inside the barn, investigators find not one, not two, but all the guns. In fact, Jason's guns. The guns that Cofell reported missing, as well as many of the other high-powered rifles and handguns. Now, remember when he called to report that they were burglarized and police came out there and they said, well, there's no broken locks. There's no forced entry. Well, he had hidden the guns in the barn and reported them all stolen. Okay.
Oh, okay.
And among those guns were not only the ones that he's stolen slash paid for, because he's a stand-up guy, but also Jason's rifles that went missing from his home that day. Okay. Also found was the .22 caliber weapon that was used to shoot Jason Pangburn. Also found was Alfred Critchley's wallet. But that was not it, Jen. That was not it. Mm-mm. Nope. The strangest item was a book that they recovered. Well, I guess it's more like a journal with random handwritten scribblings in it. You know, like maybe a manifesto or something.
Oh, yeah?
Mm-hmm. Here we go.
You don't say.
I do say, Jen. The book entitled The Orion Foundation was a manifesto of sorts, you see. In this manifesto, it called for the streets of Chatham to be cleaned up of gangs and drug dealers. They wanted to get rid of all of them. And when I say get rid of, I mean kill. I mean murder. That was their little plan, okay? This was like a group that I guess considered themselves vigilantes that were seeking justice, okay? In the manifesto book, there were several names and locations as well as photos of people that shared their beliefs, I guess. One of the names was a little bit familiar, and it also had a rank, much like the military. It had a rank after it. The person at the top of the list, their leader, I guess, is what you would say, president, whatever,
yeah,
was none other than Jason Kofell. Stephen Hill was listed as well, but he's only listed as a, quote, follower, end quote.
Oh.
That's like me and you starting a club, and I swear to God, you would make me be a follower. You'd be the leader. And then I'd be all angry about it. You know, whatever. Because of Stephen Hill being a follower, they kind of see him as maybe a weak spot. They think that might be their end, right? So they decide to target Stephen Hill. They're going to go after him. They're going to pressure him. They think he will be the one to cave, okay? So they go to him, they pull him into the station, and they make him sit down for a little interview, okay? Stephen Hill tells officers that about a year ago, Jason Kofell asked Stephen Hill if he wanted to come out to his farm and shoot some guns and have some fun. Seems like a totally normal thing to do for boys, especially around these parts.
Stephen Hill, small town.
When Stephen Hill arrived, there were a few guns already there, and he knew. He had seen these guns from the reserves. He'd been familiar with shooting guns and things like that. So with the captive audience, not to mention lots of guns around, Kofell began his lecture, okay? He starts telling Stephen, among some other fellas, that they needed to do something about all the drug dealers and gangs that were now setting up shop in Chatham. And he believed that they should come together and help get rid of this riffraff, as he would call them. And he thought that he and his friends, or followers, or however you want to say it, would do a much better job at putting the trash out, and that was his words, than the police officers or the authorities.
Okay. But aren't they kind of trash since they're killing people? They just don't consider themselves that way. I don't know.
Well, they thought they were taking the trash out because those people are, you know, whatever. And they were angry that they felt that the police weren't doing their job.
They think they were, like Dexter, but yeah. Okay.
Exactly. Yeah. But here's the bad part, Jen. These are like a bunch of Boy Scouts that, I mean, I just want to smack them. That's all I'm going to say about that, right? Because they don't end up doing anything except killing those innocent people. Just like many people like this, you know, the visionaries like David Koresh or Charlie Manson, whatever. They're all talk, right? We can do this.
Mm-hmm.
We are better than them. We can succeed, right? And it's the, I'm going to be a leader. I'm going to have all these followers and we're going to be great. We're going to take over this place, right? Because we all know how that goes. Stephen Hill continues on and he tells police that one night when Jason Kofell came over to get him, and that would be that October evening that we lost Jason and his grandparents, he asked him if he wanted to go on a mission and Hill agreed, not knowing anything at all was about to happen. The pair drive over to Jason's house and upon arriving, Kofell put a 9-shot 22 in his waistband. I don't know anything about guns. Hopefully that's right. I don't know. And he went up and he knocked on the door of the Pangburn house. Alfred answered the door and asked for Jason, the kid, which would be the other Jason. Jason asked for Jason, put it that way. Jason Pangburn comes outside on the porch and he asked them to leave. Kofell then showed Jason Pangburn a gun. Now, the gun wasn't just a regular gun. It was a really rare gun. And he offered to sell it to Jason, knowing how much Jason loved guns. So this was the trap. This was the little sticky fly paper that these evil people were placing, right? Jason wanted to test fire the gun first. He was totally into it. He was very, you know, his little eyes lit up that, you know, this is something he liked to collect. He was really into this. but he wanted to test fire the gun first. So that all of the men agreed to go over to the nearby field, which was a ravine of sorts, and he wanted to test fire the gun, make sure it worked before he bought it, right?
Right, which makes sense, yeah.
Now, the sad part, and it just breaks my heart, Jason, at this point, had no idea. He was literally asking his killer to follow him to the location in which he would be murdered. How chilling is that?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, ugh. The 9-shot revolver was given to Jason first. At the ravine, Jason would put 3 bullets into a tree, okay? That gun that he was going to purchase. He hands over the revolver to Stephen Hill, telling him it was his turn, where Hill would then shoot it 3 times as well. It's now Jason Kopfel's turn. He shoots 2 bullets into the tree, and then he turns the gun on Jason, placing the final bullet in Jason's heart. Kopfel tells
him...
No.
Scary. Just absolutely scary.
Right? Kopfel tells Hill that they need to return to the grandparents and kill them because they saw them and threatened that if they didn't go, if Hill did not accompany him, that Jason Kopfel would make Hill victim number 4. How terrible is that? So it's like, you either come with me and kill them or I'm going to kill you.
What would you do? Seriously, he'd have to kill me.
I think I'd buy my time. I think I'd go with them and the whole time be thinking, okay, what am I going to do? How am I going to get out of this? Like, what am I going to do? Right?
Yeah.
I don't know. Because I think
there's
most
no
people,
way
you're buying your time to get there, right? To try to save
right.
yourself and ideally, I guess, others.
Yeah, there's no way I could do it.
Kopfel tells Hill that he will kill Alfred and that Hill will kill the lady. Okay. I think it's funny that the lady put up a bigger fight. So there, you big jerks. They arrive at the house and Jason Kopfel tells Stephen Hill to stay with the lady and he will go occupy the old man. Hill attempts to kill Virginia, but was scared, and he claimed he couldn't do it. He couldn't go deep enough to do it, and he was hoping secretly that she would survive. So he was doing what he thought he would do to satisfy Kopfel, right?
Mm-hmm.
Meaning stab her, but she would, in fact, survive. And he did that on purpose. Like, he purposely did not plunge the knife in that deeply. Kopfel, after coming out and seeing she was still alive, is furious. He grabs the knife and he started stabbing her over and over and over like a maniac, right? That is why she was stabbed so many times versus
Hence
Alfred.
Somebody was angry. Yep. He was mad. She was getting the best of him.
Yep. Which I love. You go, girl. Hearing all the noise, Alfred comes out of the bathroom to see what's going on and is greeted by Jason Kopfel, who stabs him 3 times, causing him to fall back into the bathroom and knock out the clock plug on the way down to the ground. Kopfel then goes upstairs to grab the guns, the other guns, right, and take the wallet of Alfred on his way out the door. What a guy. What a guy, I tell ya.
Totally sweet.
As the pair are traveling away from the farm, now this is the, I don't know, it just like gives me the heebie-jeebie, chilly-willy goosebumps. I can't stand it. As Kopfel and Hill are traveling away from the farm, from the murder scene, okay, Kopfel tells Hill, hey, if anybody sees us, if anyone saw us, we're going to have to go back and we're going to have to kill them as well. It's at this exact moment, a lady on her bicycle travels past them. The lady would turn out to be none other than Jason's mom, Connie Pangburn. And on the other side of the road was Constable Mark Martin. Now, that's the constable we met at the beginning of the story.
Right.
The two, Connie and Mark, did not yet know how their lives were going to be connected in just mere moments, okay? Because Connie was heading back to the house. She's going to run into that horrible scene, run out and get Mark, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the two, they had debated going back to kill Connie, okay? Because they were afraid that she noticed them in their little gray-blue truck on the way out. And the fact that Mark Martin was nearby pretty mm-hmm. much saved her life, too, right? Because it was if they would have went back to get, you know what I'm saying? Like, that was a good thing that Mark Martin was there. You follow me on that?
I do follow you on that one.
Stephen Hill pleaded guilty to second-degree murder and was sentenced to 3 years. 3 years, Jen.
That's it.
1992, Jason Kopfel was convicted of 3 counts of first-degree murder and must serve 25 years before he can be considered for parole. Guess what? On May 4th, 2016, Jason Kopfel was released on parole.
So how long did he serve?
I don't do math, Jen. That's not my job. I don't know. Not enough. Tell you that.
Less than 3 years.
yeah, I just was looking at some stuff before we went live. So he was granted parole in May of 2016, fully, but was released to a halfway house in Peterborough. Okay. His most recent correctional plan update, right, is that he needed housing, he needed to have a stable job, and they believe that he contained high levels of accountability and motivation with medium reintegration potential. Huh. So that's it. Psychologist interviewed him, said he had some stressors related to being released into, I was going to say into the wild. That's not right. Into the world.
Well, kind of right.
I guess.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So they believe that he can make a full contributing member of society. No, thank you. You kill three people. I'm sorry. I'm hanging out.
And
who am I? Who am I?
For really no reason. That's the whole thing. You know what I mean? It's senseless. Just senseless. Very interesting.
I think it's interesting that these young kids can get, there is always one that rises to the top, right? That is like a leader. They've always been a leader. They have kids that follow them. They have kids that will do things that they want them to do. And that was Cofill, right? Mm-hmm. And that happens over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. The other thing that I think, like, I don't know, like when we pick out cases, I don't know if you go back, I think you're, my cases and your cases are different for different reasons. You know what I'm saying? Like in how we pick them out. But one of the things that that just grabbed my attention was the fact that Connie ran into that constable, officer, whatever, on the way back. And she very well might have been murdered too, had it not been him sitting there, right? Again, stars align, things happen. I don't know. So, and that was like the double, that and the thing that kids, just because I work with teenagers on the daily and think about this for them, you know, about how all this falls into play. Because, I don't know, you and I were raised pretty, like we had pretty good home life. We really did, right? I would not say that you and I would ever be mixed up like in a following like that, but who's to say, right? Like, I think it all goes together with maybe bad home life, maybe low self-esteem. I don't know.
I don't understand the whole blindly following someone and doing things.
But they never, they had this manifesto, they had members, they had guns. They never cleaned out anybody except for that poor family. They never got rid of gangbangers or drug dealers or whatever.
Right.
Is it gang? It's not gangbanger. I'm sorry. Is it a gangbanger? I don't know. I used that term with the kids and they about had a heart attack. I thought that was a term, but I guess it's not. I don't know.
It was at one point in the 90s, probably.
I think it means something else these days, if you know what I'm saying.
But oh, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They all laughed. They're like, don't say that in public. I'm like, what? That wouldn't be the first. You know, this one time I meant to say, stop goofing off and stop jacking around. And you know what I said.
Uh-huh.
I get all mad and I'm trying to be all strict. And I said, I mean it. Stop jacking off. And then everybody laughs. And then I try to maintain my composure. And then I start laughing. Because it's ruined. I already, you know, whatever. Ruined it. Sorry. Whoops.
There's two meanings. I just looked it up. One is a member of a straight gang and one that participates in the other thing. A participant
because they would call
in a gangbang.
In a street gang, you call them a banger, right? Like they're gangbanging. Mm-hmm. They're running with the gangs.
Yes.
So whatever. I don't know. Who am I?
Yep.
I'm an old lady. That's all I can say.
Just an old lady that has her own terms.
Whatever. Hey, man, as long as I know what they mean, right?
Yeah. Yeah, whatever. Right. It's the kids that make it dirty. Okay, boomer. Yeah.
We had a big talk about that in the car the other day. I'll say this to you and everybody else. For I think most people out there realize that this is kind of a thing now with the generations. The millennials were getting so much heat, and now they're fighting back against the boomers, the baby boomer generation, whatever. So the children and I, my children's and I had a big talk about this in the car, and then my son wanted to know what my mom was, which was kind of interesting. The silence generation.
The silent. Yep. So it was mine.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So it was just, and I was just like, that's really kind of interesting. So
it was right before the greatest generation, the silent generation, then the boomers. My brother is a boomer by like 1 year.
My sister's a boomer. I was going to say barely. He must barely be a boomer.
But okay, boomer now has taken the effect of our generation's whatever, you know? So
Say it to everybody.
Oh, yeah.
Be like, okay, boomer, to me. And I'm like, I'm not a boomer.
Yeah, well, it's just if you sound like curmudgeon-y you're...
Yeah, you're saying, okay, loser. Okay, you don't know what you're talking about. Oh, I know. It just cracks me up.
When people go, yeah, whatever. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the same thing. It's just the new generation. And for anybody who gets upset about it, just take a deep breath.
It's funny.
And it's
funny.
Just words.
I don't know why you'd get upset about it. Like, it's
Go away. People were trying to say that it's as bad as the N-word, and the whole thing is if you can't say...
No, it's not!
I know, but the thing is, there's two words. If you can say, okay, boomer, but you have to say the N-word, which one is worse? There you go. Boom.
Okay, boomer, that's like, okay, Jen, or okay, Cam. Like, whatever. People are crazy.
Whatever.
I had an... I'll leave you with this and this generation and how things are different. So one of my good friends came back, Hubbard, came back to sub. The teacher he was subbing for was like, you know, this is kind of a little bit of a, they're freshmen, so they're young and immature. And she said, just, you know, go check on him. So I went and checked on him, or rather I was about to go check on him, okay? And he's out in the hallway with this kid, and they look like they're just kind of like chumming it up or whatever. But the kid proceeds to go away. And I was like, okay. So he obviously sent the kid to the principal, right? So I come down there and I was like, what happened? And he goes, oh, these kids. I'm like, what did they say? Like, what happened? And it just kind of like, I don't know. It was like getting slapped in the face because these kids are just different. So there was this cute little black kid in the class and they were joking with each other. And I think they're kind of friends. I don't know. And like the okay boomer statement, he says, okay, N-word, F-word. And the kid, the black kid, kind of goes, are you, you know, he's like laughing and he goes, what'd you call? And like, they're like chumming it up. And then the teacher, of course, is like, no. And gets pulled out. And he was like, you know, we're kind of friends. I mean, I didn't mean anything. And I was like, I never thought I would hear that come out of somebody's mouth. And it's like, oh, we're friends. Like that, no. This is my whole point to this long drawn story. But it goes back to okay, boomer. Like the things that kids say to each other and you're like, oh, you know.
Yeah.
They don't get it, I guess.
I don't think they do.
No.
It's stupid.
All right, buddy. So, that's it. That's all I got. And remember, lock your doors.
And keep passing by those open windows.
Bye-bye.
Love ya.